Of all the loveliness you can find in the world, nothing is more stunning than what shines from inner beauty. And I want to tell you the story of a woman whose beauty has inspired countless. And maybe you know the story. I'm talking about Corrie ten Boom. Let me tell you about Corrie. Now, I like Corrie especially because she was Dutch. Just like my family, and in my family we say, if you ain't Dutch, you ain't much. So I like her because she was a good Dutch woman. So anyway, Corrie was part of the resistance movement in World War II in the Netherlands. And her family, they were watchmakers, and they lived above their watchmaking shop. But her extended family, they were all kind of watchmakers. And what they did in their family is they used this watchmaking business to make and maintain contacts with lots of people, but especially those that were Jews fleeing for their life. And they created, in the Netherlands, a kind of network not all that dissimilar from the Underground Railroad that we would know much more about here in our own country. And the Ten Boons were at the middle of the Underground Railroad system for hiding Jews during World War II in the Netherlands. So like I said, her family lived above the watchmaking shop, so you got to think of a bottom floor where the business was, and then an upper floor where they lived. And in that upper floor, when World War II broke out, they built, her dad and uncles built a secret room in the second story. And she called that room, in the book that she wrote years later, called The Hiding Place. And they called that room The Hiding Place for two reasons. Obviously, number one, because it was a place where they hid Jews. But secondly, and probably more importantly, from Psalm 119, 114, which was like her family's verse, it says, "You are my hiding place and my shield. I will trust in your word." So during the years 1943 and 1944, the Ten Boom family never had less than about five or six or seven illegal people, illegal Jews, and those fleeing from the Gestapo living in their house. And those people would always have to learn how to easily and quickly get into the secret chamber, this hiding place. Through the efforts in those 2 years specifically, 43 and 44, she estimates that her family actively participated in their house, not talking about the whole network, but just in her house. Their family saved over 800 Jews. Now just imagine that. 800 Jews lived because this family broke the law, and to be clear, they were breaking the law. They broke the law to hide them in their house. It's not the first time that Christians have had to do the wrong thing in order to do the right thing. In 1944, she and her brother and her sister and father were arrested along with 30 other people that were part of the extended network for this Underground Railroad. The only ones in her house that were not arrested were the six Jews hiding in the secret chamber. They were not arrested. Everybody else and the whole network was arrested. They were put in prison. And in a short time, all 30 were released. Everyone was released except her sister and her dad, and of course, Corrie. In a short time, her dad in prison contracted a disease and he died. The sisters then were shipped off to a concentration camp called Ravensbrück. And there they spent the rest of the year. Her sister later on died of disease in the concentration camp. But meanwhile, the sisters worked hard at sharing Christ with those in the concentration camp. And you guys have seen the pictures of the conditions and the living conditions of those concentration camps and the fleas and the bugs and the feces and all that went along with it. And she was right there in the midst of that. And her sister really worked hard at sharing Christ. And she has all these great stories about these prisoners that would come to Christ and these conversations that they would have. And some of them would come to Christ literally hours before being marched off to execution. Well, her sister died later that year, and Corrie was at the end of 1944. She was released and made her way back to her family. She then spent the rest of her life, another 60 years, as I remember. But she traveled all around. She went to 60 different countries. And she went around with a message of forgiveness and reconciliation. And her message was always entitled, Jesus is the Victor. Corrie ten Boom. And she's just one, I think, of many heroines that have done just extraordinary things through very difficult circumstances and have prevailed, they've persevered. Sometimes they've been just behind the scenes, but they've done amazing feats. And what we're going to look at today in this series called Unforgotten is one of these heroines that behind the scenes was a woman of great strength. And an amazing beauty, but somebody who had far more beauty on the inside. Her name was Abigail, and I'm going to tell her story out of 1 Samuel 25. 1 Samuel 25, so if you go there with me today, we're going to read most of this chapter at various times as we work our way through the story. 1 Samuel 25, and again, we're telling the story of a wonderful heroine who was beautiful on the outside, but far more beautiful on the inside. And there was a strength to her character that I think we're going to see today in the story. 1 Samuel 25, I'm going to begin in verse 1 because that's really where the story begins. It says, verse 1, 1 Samuel 25, verse 1 says, Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. And that's really where the story begins, and that's actually a very important detail. Because Samuel was David, the famous King David, David's mentor. And as this story begins in 1 Samuel 25, King David loses his mentor. Now at this point of the story, which is kind of like late early in his story, he's still an outlaw. He's like Robin Hood. Before Robin Hood was around, he would go around and he would fight injustice and he would protect the people. And so he was an outlaw. But this outlaw still had this mentor, this man who would give him godly advice in his life, this man Samuel, the guy that anointed him from his father's, when he was being the shepherd, if you remember those stories. But in verse 1, David's mentor and friend died. And David is left then kind of rudderless. And as always happens when a mentor dies and someone is left rudderless, he or she could be given to rash decision, and David was no exception. Let's keep reading. Verse 2, now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 3,000 goats and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and behaved badly. He was a Calebite. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you and peace to your house and peace to all that you have. I hear you have shears. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David. So here we're introduced to Abigail. And it says in the text that Abigail was discerning, and she was beautiful. So she was somebody we could say who was beautiful on the inside and beautiful on the outside. She was unfortunately married to a guy who was neither of those things. A brash man, a merciless man, a hard man. So in your mind, you got to create the scenario where Abigail marries into this toxic situation with a very difficult man. Now, there's a few things that we know because of the culture of the time. We know that probably this was an arranged marriage. So this wasn't Abigail choosing to marry this kind of harsh guy, this merciless guy, this guy who behaved badly. It was likely an arranged marriage. which means that Abigail was probably quite a bit younger than Nabal, which again makes the situation even more difficult. And now we know in the story here, Nabal was quite wealthy. So we can maybe guess that mom and dad in this arranged marriage were seeking for a way to improve Abigail's lot and maybe even improve their own lot by having her marry into this wealthy house with Nabal. So that was how people did it back then. They arranged marriages and they found suitors that would help the situation, help the family, whether it was a wealthy person or aristocracy, but some kind of advantage that they would have in life. And so this was probably one of those kinds of marriages. Now we know that in 1 Chronicles 3, it says that Abigail was from Carmel, the very same place where Nabal and his fortune and his farm and his sheep, they were all there in Carmel. So she was a local girl. Her parents would have probably been nearby, family, brother, sister, we don't know. And it could be that part of Nabal's wealth supported and maintained her extended family, which happened frequently at that time. Now, all we read about her in verse 3 is that she was beautiful and discerning. And again, beautiful on the inside, beautiful on the outside. Maybe we could say she had beauty and brains, one way of looking at that. But the contrast in verse 3 is the difference between Abigail and Nabal. Abigail, beautiful, discerning. Nabal, harsh, and behaved badly. And we're going to see in a few minutes as we read through this, he was considered a fool. He was a drunkard at the end of the story. And so when you look at that situation, and you think of the arranged marriage, you think, what parent in the right mind would marry off their daughter kind of place to that kind of man? And maybe mom and dad didn't know. Maybe Nabal wasn't that way at first. We just don't know. We just know that she married into a very difficult situation. And it didn't matter that he had a lot of money, because there is no amount of money in the world that can ease the misery of a bad marriage. Now, as was the custom of the day, as we read the story along here in these first 8 verses, David's men cared for those that were around them. And Nabal would have been one of those that they protected. Protected literally with sword and arrow, with horses, and just made sure that everything was okay around them. But in doing that, they expected some form of payment. It wasn't like a legal contract. It was more like for services rendered, here's a thank you kind of thing. And there's some people that look at this and they say, well, David was extorting Nabal. Or they look at this as kind of a mafia, pay-for-protection kind of scheme. But in the first century, there were a lot of these kinds of situations. And Carmel, on the south side of Israel, was right in the edge of the wilderness, right in the edge of Israeli civilization, so very vulnerable to attacks from the outside. So they would have needed some kind of protection like David would have been able to give. And so we could even surmise a little bit that perhaps part of the reason why Nabal was wealthy was exactly because David and his men were protecting the assets of Nabal. So you can see why David would expect some kind of remuneration for his work. Let's go back to the story, verse 9. When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed from my shears and give it to men who come from I don't know where?" So David's young men turned away and came back and told all of this. And David said to his men, "Every man strap on his sword." And every man strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. Well, so now Nabal has done it. David's men arrived, and they politely, very politely, asked for payment. And Nabal, just like we learn in verse 3, and as we learn throughout the story, he acts foolishly. He behaves badly in the phrase from the Bible. And he acts offensively. And that's the important thing to realize in all this. He acts offensively because he subtly suggests that David is nothing more than a usurper, some wannabe to the throne. And he refused to acknowledge God's anointing of David to be the next king. So you can see why David was ticked to hear what Nabal said. And Nabal is now shaking the wrath of the giant killer, David. What did he expect would happen? Verse 14, let's keep on reading. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when they were in the fields as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us by day and by night, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore know this and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house, for he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him." Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 seahs of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, "Go on before me. Behold, I come after you." But she did not tell her husband Nabal. So Abigail learns of her husband's treachery. She learns what he said, not only his reaction, but also this subtle suggestion that David was a nobody, this usurper to the throne. And so she decides that she's going to save the day. And save the day from what? Look at verse 21 and 22. Here's what it says. "Now David had said, 'Surely in vain I've guarded all that this man has in the wilderness so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. And he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by the morning I leave so much as 1 male of all who belong to him.'" That's the save the day. David is coming, and he's going to kick some rear end. Now, you got to understand, this is David, renowned. This is David, Goliath killer. This is David, he's killed his tens of thousands. This is David with 400 men coming after Nabal. But let's pause and ask some questions. And I want to ask a question or two, but I don't want you to judge my question. And therefore, don't judge me, okay? We know Abigail had a less than favorable marriage, right? And we know that David was on his way to kill her husband. Why didn't she just sit back and do nothing? Why didn't she just let David come? Why didn't she just do what would have been expected of a good wife, to respect her husband's wishes and to sit back and do nothing? Why didn't she do that? Because in doing nothing, it seems to me like one of her problems could have been solved. Now, again, don't judge me harshly for asking the question, because I think it's a fair question. Yes, she was trying to save all the men, but it seems like doing nothing would have been a solution to at least consider. But she didn't. And for 3,000 years, Abigail has been regarded as this great heroine. In fact, in the Mishnah, these Jewish writings, she is considered one of the most discerning. And it's funny, in the writings, it says that she was one of the top 4 most beautiful women to have ever lived. Now, how they knew that, got no idea. But that's what it says. So she's been so highly regarded all of these years, literally 3,000 years, for not sitting back and doing nothing. But my question has to do with this. Didn't she go behind Nabal, her husband's back, and doing what she did? I mean, he had made his decision. He had already sent the messengers back. And she went behind his back. And when you look at that, what you realize is that there is a perception of submission that perhaps Abigail does not quite fit into. You see, sometimes I think that there is this idea of submission that is romanticized in the Bible, and therefore romanticized among us, that may not quite be accurate. because she had played the quiet, mousy, timid, shy, say nothing, do nothing woman in the background, every single man in her household would have died that day. But she didn't. Could it be that our understanding of submission and headship in the marriage and in the church is perhaps less based upon the Bible and more based upon what some people want the Bible to say? Could it be that we have it backwards a little bit? Because I think if the Bible celebrates women of strength like Abigail, then perhaps we should admire them too. And not just say, oh, she just did that thing and she was that one-time thing. But here's what it feels like to me. It feels like at times we admire people like Abigail, these women of strength that do amazing feats. But sometimes we don't admire women of strength within our own church. How is it that we could admire somebody like Abigail, but when there is a woman of strength in our own church, we tell her, you need to sit off to the side and you need to be quiet? That's the struggle in reading this story for me. So listen, godly men do not fear strong women, in part because we understand that God made them exactly the way He made them. And we need to honor God by honoring them even in their strength. Could it be, men, that it's really our own insecurities that sometimes come out in the way that we talk to women? I think it feels hypocritical to talk out of one side of our mouth and admire the qualities and the character of a woman like Abigail, and then talk out of the other side of our mouth and admire less those characteristics in the women around us. So hear me very clearly. I'm not saying, and I'm not advocating that we ignore clearly Bible-ordained roles of men and women. What I am saying is that for somebody like me who's been in the church my whole life, and somebody like me who my wife can attest, DeWitt women are strong women. And my sisters, my mom, my extended family, they are strong women. And they have so often, not that I want to put words in their mouth, but they have so often felt set aside in the church and not respected and honored for their gifts and abilities because they're strong. And it feels like a double standard to say we admire Abigail, but we don't admire these strong women and the way that God made them. And I think over time, our church as a whole, not just our church, but the church, we've done a poor job of clearly understanding love and respect and honor and submission in the church and in the marriage, and understanding the difference between the two. So ladies, if I can just say, if you have ever felt in the church that you have been marginalized or dishonored or looked down on, or told, you know, your place is off to the side or your place is quiet, I just want to say that I'm sorry that you have been treated that way, especially in a place in the church where we honor, from the Bible's point of view, we honor women of strength. And I'm sorry that at times we've not done a good job of honoring you. That's the tension in this story for me. Because I feel like we put up on a pedestal and we admire women like Abigail, but in the modern church, in the modern time, we don't do the same with those women of strength around us. And that bothers me. Let's keep going with the story. Let's see what happens here. Verse 23. So just to pick up the story, Abigail, she puts together all of this food. She sends it ahead of her with her servants, probably because she wasn't ready yet. She was still in the bathroom, just saying. And then she takes off after to find David. Verse 23. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from the blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. Now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant. For the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you as long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and seek your life, and the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause or for my Lord taking vengeance on himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant." Let's keep going here. "And David said to Abigail, 'Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from avenging myself with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male.' Then David received from her hand what she had brought, and he said to her, 'Go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice and have granted your petition.'" Two more verses. "And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. She told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning when the wine had gone out of him, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within in him, and he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died." Well, this is the part of the story that I really love. And it's a little bit kind of mixed up in there a little bit. Let me try to unpackage it just a little bit for you. First of all, I love that Abigail acted even though she had no idea how this was all going to turn out. So when she orders the figs and the bread and the cakes and the sheep and all of the food put together, she had no idea if it would help or if it was going to be too late. As she rode on her donkey, and as she chased after David, she didn't know if she was riding to her death. She knew none of that. She had no inkling that David would find it good, find it bad, what he would do. She fell down on her face before him. She didn't know if this warrior, this outlaw, would pull out the sword, hack off her head. She didn't know any of it. And yet she acted decisively. And I love that she had so much faith that she was doing the right thing, that even though she didn't know how it was going to turn out, she still acted decisively. And I think on the way, she probably had a private conversation with herself. Like, do you guys talk to yourself? I do all the time. You know, do you have these like private conversations like, okay, I'm going to say this, and then he's going to say this, and when he says this, I'm going to say this. But if he says this, then I'm going to reply this, and it's going to be great. I'm sure on that road she was having one of those conversations, because she knew she had one chance to save the day, one chance to say the right thing, and she was working on her speech. What am I going to say? I have to save all the men. I have to save my household, and I don't want to blow it. And then you can imagine as she's riding along there on her donkey chasing after David's men, she sees the dust in the distance. She knows the 400 men of David are on their way. She sees the dust kicking up, and her heart really starts going, and she's really getting nervous. Time is there. It is time. It is go time. David pulls up. She pulls up. It is really time. What is going to happen? And she falls to the ground. She bows her head, And she delivers her speech with humility, respect, and honor. Three things that Nabal did not show in his response. And there's kind of three things in her speech that are fascinating. First, right at the beginning, she takes responsibility for what her husband did. She takes responsibility, even though she had nothing to do with it, even though she thought it was a terrible decision, she still took responsibility for it. And I think in that, we see a little bit of a picture of what the Bible means when it talks about real submission. Because in what she says, in her taking the responsibility, we see her protecting her husband. This is an act of protection. And she's protecting her husband even from himself. And I think that's an aspect of this submission that we so rarely talk about. And just the role of protecting husband and wife and wife to husband and this role of protection within submission. Second thing that I see here is that she directs David's attention not to her gifts, maybe we could say not to her feminine wiles, but to the Lord. In fact, one time she mentions her gifts, seven times she mentions the Lord and his promises to David. And then David, when he praises her, he doesn't praise her for her beauty. He praises her for her insight, her counsel, her thoughts, her discernment. And I think in this we find this wonderful principle that nothing is more attractive to a man who loves the Lord than a woman who is godly. Nothing is more attractive to a man who loves the Lord than a godly woman. Now, if I can convince the young men and young women of our church that this is true, oh, I could save you so much pain. That's right, bro. This is so true. And our world wants to paint that the outside is the important part. And what you see is on the outside. If our teenage girls, I just thought of this, if our teenage girls would spend as much time cultivating their heart as they do working on the outside, what a difference it would make. And it's part of the lie that what is on the outside is more important than what's on the inside. Listen, there is nothing that is more attractive. When a guy really loves the Lord and he sees that kind of heart in a woman, that is attractive. Godliness, men and women, this is what is most attractive to people who love the Lord. I probably could preach a whole message on that. Man. So I love that this discernment comes out and her godliness comes out. I love that she diverts his attention, in a sense, even away from her beauty, but she diverts his attention straight to the promises of God. He's thinking revenge, she's thinking promises. He's thinking vengeance, she's talking about, Lord has promised this to you. She diverts his attention straight to the Lord. And I think that's why husbands who have godly wives have a very precious gift. Because if we're honest, we guys, we can be harsh and our egos can get hurt and we make bad decisions and sometimes we have fears. We're afraid we're going to lose it all and one more season and we can brood and be moody and all of those things. And in the moments of hardship, when a husband is going through one of those kinds of things and he has a wife who diverts him back to the promises of the Lord, that kind of wife is very precious to that man. And I think that in the design of God and this honor and submission that we read about in the New Testament, wives can be an indispensable stabilizing force in the life of their husband. But I think that there is a very subtle truth in that. And here's the subtle truth. That no one can point anyone to the promises of God if they don't know what those promises are. And sometimes the expectation we have is that everybody's going to know these things. But that's just not how it works. You cultivate strength when times are good and times are easy, so you have that strength to lean on in the difficult times. So if you don't build that solid foundation of strength in the good times, You have nothing to lean on in the hard times, and you fold. So maybe you have the sense that somehow Abigail, between her house and finding David, that's when she became a woman of strength. Like in the 30-minute ride in her Mercedes donkey. That's when she really became strong. But listen, that is not when she became strong. That is when she delved deep into the strength that she had already cultivated. That's when she had it to lean on. So she cultivated it long before the hardship came. And then she could lean on it when times were difficult. And I have known, just as a side note to all of this, she cultivated this even though her husband had none of it. I have known so many godly women who cultivate fabulous depth with the Lord and have husbands that are detached and uninterested in spiritual things. And some ladies, we know, some of you come here alone, some of you feel alone, some of you have husbands that you wish would engage with you spiritually. I just want you to know that there are people like Abigail, there are ladies like Abigail that have gone deep with the Lord and they've cultivated strength in the Lord, even though their husbands didn't. Don't let your man hold you back. You go, even if he doesn't. The third thing in the speech that I find very interesting is what she's arguing. This is kind of her point, and it takes her forever to get to the point. But her argument is something like this. David, we know you're going to be king someday. And when you're king someday, you're going to have grief over what you're about to do. You're going to regret what you're about to do. You're going to regret that you lost your temper. You're going to regret that you were like defending your honor and you killed Nabal and all of his men. So basically, her argument is this. Let the coming glory that you are to have regulate your present action. Let the glory that you are to have someday regulate your present action, which is a really interesting, very interesting point, because in the New Testament, we find exactly the same thing. We find Paul saying that we have died with Christ, we've been buried with Christ, but we've been raised together with him, that we're going to sit in the heavenly places with him, that the glory of heaven is ours someday. And then Paul says, because this is all true, live today like it's really true. Live today like that's true. And it's so fascinating to me that Abigail would use this argument all the way back in the Old Testament, and then we'd see with Paul him using the exact same argument. That when we really believe that the glory is ours someday, that it changes and it regulates how we live now. It's Romans 5 and 6. Now that I hate to bring that up again, but we've talked a little bit about Romans 5 and 6 this year. It's justification and holiness. Now that you're saved, let's live holy. Do you realize that there are so many of us that are going to get to heaven and realize how much better and how differently we could have lived for the glory of God in this earth, and we're going to wish we did? Don't get to heaven and regret how you lived here. That's her argument. How ironic that when Abigail presented her case to David, his heart softened. But when she told the news to Nabal, his heart hardened in anger and jealousy and fear that led to his death. Two very different responses by two very different men. So what happened? Let's look at verse 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal, and has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head." Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said, "David has sent us to take you to be his wife." Sounds really harsh. Didn't mean it that way. And as she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, "Behold, your handmaiden is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." And David and Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her five women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. So basically, David hears that Nabal is dead, and he offers to marry Abigail, which is really an interesting part of the story. And if I were to say, what was it that so attracted David to Abigail? How would you answer? You see, David not once in all of 1 Samuel 25 refers to her outward beauty. But there's something like 9 times that he refers to what he saw in her heart. He refers to her godliness. So at the end of the day, what attracted David most to Abigail had nothing to do with what was on the outside. It had everything to do with what was on the inside. Now the really fascinating part of the story, I think, is do you remember where we began? Samuel dies. Samuel, David's mentor, dies, and David's left without a spiritual advisor. And then we have this entire chapter where this unlikely new spiritual advisor comes into David's life. Instead of it being the prophet Samuel, it's actually this woman, Abigail. And it was her godliness that attracted David to her. And what a precious, precious jewel she was to David, because his life is about to get very, very difficult. And she was a precious jewel because no beauty shines brighter than that of a godly heart. No beauty shines brighter than that of a godly heart. I was reminded by my wife last night that I have a daughter named Abigail. And, you know, I think when you name your kids, you really work hard at, you know, what does it mean and all of those things. And I didn't even really remember all those years ago that we labored with the name Abigail and why we wanted to call her Abigail. But one of the reasons why was because of this story of the strength of her character. And it's something that I have admired for years. That's the story of Abigail. Next week, we're going to continue on with one of my favorite Old Testament stories, a guy named Mephibosheth, which you guys will have to work all week to be able to say Mephibosheth correctly. It's going to be a great story, and it's probably a guy that very few know very well.